outside rumbled in the evening air, making communication difficult. To Harris's right, the bright orange orb of the sun was falling beneath the horizon. To his left, storm clouds were moving in. The first was a good sign. Darkness was something that he welcomed. But the second was not. Wind and rain did not go well with parachuting. The pilots were flying up and down a 15-mile corridor 5 miles east of the White House. Harris and his fellow SEALs had made every jump there was. He'd done both high-altitude high-opening, hey-ho, and high-altitude low-opening, halo, jumps, as well as static line jumps from 500 feet all the way up to 30,000-plus. 8 years earlier, when he had participated in the exercise for the Secret Service, he and his men had conducted a hey-ho jump out of the back of an Air Force C-141 Starlifter. At an altitude of 25,000 feet, the men leapt from the plane and popped their chutes. From almost 5 miles up, Harris and his men expertly guided their double canopy parachutes over a 45-mile distance and set themselves down gently on the roof of the executive mansion. At first, the Secret Service was shocked by the results. But after they sat with the SEALs and realized the years of training and high level of skill that such a jump required, they ruled the possibility of a terrorist group successfully conducting such an operation all but impossible. Harris and his men were about to put all of their jumping skills to use. General Campbell had briefed him minutes earlier on the newest aspect of the plan, and it was creating a mathematical nightmare for the SEALs. No longer would they be able to choose their jump time. They would now have to wait for Aziz to make his move and then quickly get the plane into position. Repeating the jump he had done 8 years earlier was not an option. Jumping from that altitude would have required that he and his men and the crew of the unpressurized aircraft go on oxygen an hour before takeoff. By the time his plan was approved, they had missed that window of opportunity. There wasn't enough time, so Harris had decided they would jump from 10,000 feet and go into a free-fall glide for the White House. At 1,000 feet, they would pop their chutes and float down the last leg. Commander Harris moved away from the back of the ramp to inform his men of the impending rain. Inside, the bleak cargo area glowed with the red light to help the men gain their night vision. Harris had brought along the large Mick Reavers, who was serving as the jump master, and Tony Clark and Jordan Rostein, two of Six's best shooters and demolitions experts. All four men were dressed in their black Nomex coveralls, balaclava hoods, and gloves. The fire-retardant material was a must in any operation, and even more so when dealing with explosives. Operating in a dry environment, all of the men were carrying 9mm Sig Sauer P226 pistols, integrally silenced MP10s, and a bevy of extra magazines in their assault vests that fit snugly over their Kevlar body armor. Radio checks had been completed on the ground. The four operators were using Motorola MX-300 radios rigged with throat mics and earpieces. Harris approached his men and screamed over the wind, "That storm keeps coming in from the east, and it doesn't look good." Clark shook his head at his CO. He'd known Harris for over a decade and knew the man to be just crazy enough to try to jump in the middle of a storm. Clark reached up and adjusted his goggles. While doing so, he leaned closer to Harris. Over the roar, he yelled, "We ain't jumping in the rain, Harry." Harris nodded, and then, turning back for the ramp, he muttered to himself, "We'll see." Out the rear of the plane, Harris saw the storm intensifying. Suddenly, a flash of lightning lit up the sky and streaked toward the ground in two separate veins. The strike was followed by a crack that could be heard over the roar of the engines. Sheets of rain could be seen falling over the Chesapeake. The rain would continue to roll in across the Maryland countryside and envelop the capital. They had 30 minutes tops before the rain rendered the jump suicidal. Rapp and Adams were ready to go. They were at the door going over the final checklist. If things went sour, HRT was 20 seconds away from breaching the building, and Delta Force could be on site to secure the president in under 2 minutes. Now was the time to take risks and roll the dice. Before telling him to punch in the code, Rapp asked Adams, "Are you good to go, Milt?" Adams pulled off his baseball cap, and with a handkerchief he wiped a layer of sweat from his bald black head. Then, with a nod, he said, "I'm ready." Rapp did one last quick check of his equipment and said, "Iron Man to control. We're going in. Over." Rapp then nodded to Adams, who punched in the code. At the first sound of air escaping from the gasket-sealed door, Adams stepped back, allowing Rapp to move forward and take the lead. Rapp didn't know what to expect on the other side. The door could be booby-trapped. Aziz could have a guard posted on the other side. There was no way of knowing. Rapp had to guess. With a limited amount of resources, Rapp thought, Aziz wouldn't be able to afford to place a guard outside the door. And that was assuming he had found it. The bigger concern was a bomb. Rapp pushed Adams against the wall closet to the door's hinges and placed his hand on the handle. After pausing for a moment, he turned his head away, pushed down on the handle, and pulled the door in 2 inches. Hiding behind the heavy steel door to protect him from the possible blast, Rapp listened for the telltale sound of a tripwire pulling a pin. He counted to 3, then 5 for good measure. With his left hand clutching his MP10, he reached back with his right, and Adams handed him the snake. Rapp nosed the tiny fiber-optic camera around the corner. He scanned to the left, to the right, and then up. The shadowy images were being broadcast back to Langley. Over his headset, he heard the voice of General Campbell.
"Everything looks good, Iron Man."
Rapp peeked around the door to get a better look. To his left was a set of steep concrete stairs. Rapp had half expected the passageway to be dark. Instead, the hidden staircase that led up to the Oval Office was dimly lit with only 2 bulbs. Straight ahead, a sliver of light shone from underneath a door that led to Horsepower, the Secret Service's Presidential Detail Command Post. That was where the alarm systems and surveillance cameras were monitored. All video surveillance of both the grounds and the interior of the West Wing, Executive Mansion, and East Wing were monitored by the new Joint Operations Command across the street in the EOB. Horsepower was concerned primarily with the president and watched only the areas of the compound where the president was. The uniformed division was responsible for everything else. In Rapp's Secret Service briefing, they had explained that in the moments after the raid, the interior cameras around the White House began to go offline one by one. The obvious reason was Aziz did not want the Secret Service to be able to watch what he was doing. Rapp's responsibility was to discover how much of the system was still online and if any tangos were monitoring it. Stepping completely from behind the door, Rapp carefully edged forward into the small landing area just outside of Horsepower. Adams followed close behind, then slid the tiny lens under the door and began working it from one side of the room to the other. Rapp watched over his shoulder. A couple of old metal desks came into view, and then they spotted something. Rapp gestured for Adams to bring it back. There, all the way across the room, were the shoulders and head of a man.
"Mark 1 Tango," said General Campbell over Rapp's headset. "That's the control panel. Can you get us a better look at what he's watching?"
Adams zoomed the camera in on the man sitting behind the door. In front of the terrorist were a dozen small black and white monitors mounted in a metal rack. The bottom middle 2 were obscured by the man's head, but the 10 other monitors all appeared to be showing images of the exterior of the White House. Rapp turned away from the door and, in as soft a voice as possible, asked, "You're recording this, right?"
"That's affirmative," replied Campbell.
"Good. We're going to plant a monitor here and move on." Rapp fished one of the micro video and audio surveillance transmitters out of his pocket and turned it on. Then, setting it on the floor, he edged the unit's thin fiber-optic camera under the door as far as it would go. Turning away from the door again, he whispered, "Are you receiving the new signal?"
"That's affirmative."
Rapp tapped Adams on the shoulder and pointed up the stairs. Adams retracted the snake and coiled it back into a loose loop. Before proceeding, Rapp bent over and checked for any tripwires. After making sure it was safe, he took the lead. At the top, there was no landing, just the interior of the wall panel that accessed the area between the Oval Office and the President's private dining room. Adams pointed to a latch and said, "It opens in." Rapp nodded. He would have preferred to have quietly drilled a hole in the wall and inserted a camera to see what was on the other side, but they were short on time. Rapp pressed the latch and held his MP10 ready. The narrow section of the wall popped in. Pulling it open further, Rapp looked out across the hall at President Hayes's private study. Almost instantly, his nostrils filled with a ripe stench. The smell crawled into the stairwell, and Rapp started breathing through his mouth. Remembering Adams, he turned and whispered, "I think there are some dead bodies up here. Are you going to be all right?" Adams nodded and waved Rapp forward. Rapp pointed at Adams and then the ground, signaling for him to stay put for a second. Rapp moved to the right and hugged the wall. The failing evening light came through the windows. In the dining room ahead, the overhead light was lit, as well as a table lamp. It was as if the building were stuck in time. Several half-filled coffee cups littered the table, and a tray filled with dishes was waiting to be carted away. To the right, the pantry door was open, and Rapp could see out into the main hallway. This caused him to pull back a step. Everything Rapp saw, the people back at Langley saw. Campbell came over his headset.
"Iron Man, there is a door on your left that leads out into the Rose Garden."
Rapp's head swiveled toward the door, and the general said,
"That's it. Let's check it for explosives."
"Roger." Looking back to make sure there was no one in the hallway, Rapp moved out around the left side of the dining room table. A large plant stood next to the door, and behind was the same gray metal box Rapp had seen in the president's bedroom. From the side of the box, a clear filament wire wove its way through a series of eyelet screws. The clear wire, really nothing more than fishing line, went across the base of the door, through another eyelet screw, up 3 feet, where it went through another looped eyelet, and then began its horizontal course across the door again. Rapp followed it to the other side and stopped.
"Shit. What is it?" asked Campbell.
"You can't see the wire?"
"No."
"It runs across the base of the door, up 3 feet, and then back across. But the big problem is it doesn't stop." Rapp walked along the wall, eyeing the clear wire as he went. "It runs all along the wall, not just the door."
"That could be a problem."
They had guessed that the doors would be wired, so the HRT was planning to blow mouse holes in the walls to enter the building. With wire running across the walls, that wouldn't work.
"I'm going to keep moving. We'd better hope those seals are good or we're in a lot of trouble."
Rapp walked quickly back toward the other end of the room. Instead of heading back into the short hallway, he cut into the pantry and carefully approached the door that led out into the main hallway of the first floor of the West Wing. Clutching the thick grip of his integral suppressor, he inched his way to the doorframe. His eyes were instantly drawn to the trails of dark, dried blood that stained the hallway carpeting. The blood came from both directions, as if bodies had been dragged, and went into the room that was across the hall and to the right. Rapp didn't want to think about what was behind the closed door, but believed it was probably what was causing the grotesque smell. As he checked up and down the hallway, he noticed another bomb to his left. Rapp cringed and tried to focus the head cam on the gray metal box. This was worse than he thought. Not only was there an outer layer of bombs, it appeared there was also an inner layer to contend with. Rapp retreated to join Adams.
"Did you get a bead on that second bomb and its location?" "Affirmative. Was the discoloration on the carpeting what I thought it was?"
"It looked like it was dry blood," replied Rapp as he reached Milt Adams's position. Rapp continued past him 2 steps and poked his head into the Oval Office. Instantly, he saw the cause of the smell. The bloated body of a man lay between the 2 couches on the floor. His head had fallen next to the embroidered presidential seal and had deposited a large pool of blood. Rapp edged around the first sofa and tried to get a look at the man's face, but it did no good. His cheeks and neck were so swollen they looked as if they might break the binds of the dress shirt and necktie. The man's hands had suffered the same gross expansion. Rapp moved on and checked the curved wall behind the president's desk. Near the door that led into the oval colonnade, he found another bomb. The clear wire traversed the wall horizontally twice. Exhaling, he said, "Same thing as the other room. I'm taking Milt, and we're going to check out the interior." Adams was standing in the doorway, looking at the puffy body on the floor. As Rapp pulled close, he asked, "Do you recognize him?" Adams shook his head. Rapp jerked the barrel of his gun back in the direction from which they had come. As he walked into the dining room, he hugged the wall to his right and kept his gun up and leveled. He turned back to Adams and asked, "There's a door right across the hall here. Where does it lead?"
"The Roosevelt room."
"What's in there?"
"Just a big conference table."
Rapp nodded. "Okay. I'm going to cover you from this little room here. I want you to go across the hall to the Roosevelt room and stick the snake under the door. And remember, stay on the left side of the door frame. Don't stand in the middle." Adams nodded his little head. Rapp had been adamant about where to stand so as not to get shot. Rapp moved and stepped into the small pantry off the dining room. At the doorway to the main hall, he eased his head out and checked in both directions. His right hand came up by his shoulder, and he waved Adams forward. Milt scampered through the pantry and across the hall. The door to the Roosevelt room was just to his right, and the main door to the Oval Office was almost directly across the hall from it. Staying on the left side, as Rapp had told him, Adams eased the tip of the snake under the door and stared at the monitor. He wasn't sure at first what it was that he was looking at. There were lumps on the floor, and the large conference table had been overturned and flipped against the far wall. Something moved, and that's when he figured out that the lumps on the floor were bodies. What had moved was a leg. A leg wearing blue trousers with a red stripe running down the side. Adams immediately recognized the pants as those belonging to a U.S. Marine. A pair of more discerning eyes were back at Langley, watching both the shots from the head cams and the fiber optic snake. General Campbell's voice came over Adams's headset.
"Milt, give me a full sweep nice and slow, and then pull back away from the door."
Adams turned the dial with his thumb and slowly moved the snake from the left to the right and then back again. When he was done, Campbell told him,
"That's good. Now bug out."
Adams withdrew the snake and went back across the hall to join Rapp. Rapp whispered into his lip mic,
"Control, what did you see? Over."
"One tango at 11 o'clock sitting in a chair facing your door holding what appears to be an AK-74 in his lap."
As Rapp listened, he could hear other voices in the background. Campbell came back seconds later.
"I've been advised that there are two other entrances into the room, one of which is blocked. On the floor, we appear to have at least a half dozen hostages, maybe more. They look to be tied and wearing hoods."
Adams, who was standing just behind Rapp, was hearing the same thing, and he added,
"One of those men in there is a Marine." "That's affirmative. We are reviewing the tape to see what else we can get, but for now, it looks like we've found our missing hostages."
Rapp peeked back around the corner and then looked at the base of the door to the Roosevelt room. Turning his head back toward Adams, he whispered,
"Milt, fish out one of the surveillance units. Bend the lens at a right angle and stick it to the base of the door. I'll cover you."
Adams nodded, walking quietly across the hall, and placed the camera. Rapp asked,
"Control, how does the new feed look?"
"Good. We've got about 80% of the room, and the tango is in the picture."
Rapp turned back to Adams.
"Rig me two of the black ones."
Adams steadied the first one and handed it off to Rapp, who stepped out into the hallway. Immediately to his right was a small credenza with an arrangement of wilting flowers sitting in an ornate vase. Rapp reached behind the credenza and stuck the surveillance unit to the back of it. Stepping back into the pantry, he retrieved the second unit and placed it underneath the credenza at an angle that would cover the hallway as it went in the other direction. Chapter 50.
Mustafa Yassin was proud of his work. He double-checked his progress again and grinned. With satisfaction, he flipped off the power switches on all three drills and backed the bits out of their holes. He had reached the proper depth early. Yassin did not have the brawn of men like Aziz, but he was smarter than most. The little thief had learned from dealing with men like Saddam to pad his estimates and manage his superior's expectations. The main drill, and the largest of the three, sat on a tripod. Yassin tugged at the base and pulled it back out of the way. The other two drills were magnetized. After wresting them from the door, he sat on his toolbox and lit up a cigarette. The plump man inhaled deeply and picked up his radio. He toggled the transmit button and called Aziz. Aziz was snacking on a sandwich in the galley of the White House mess when he heard the call. Pulling his radio to his mouth, he said,
"Mustafa, this is Rafiq. What do you want?"
"I am ready for you."
Aziz set his sandwich down and wiped the crumbs from his fingers.
"Say again?"
"I am ready for you. When you arrive, I will proceed with the last part."
Aziz was elated.
"I will be over shortly."
Grabbing his MP5 from the counter, he walked out into the mess and looked over the mass of huddled hostages. There was one person in particular he was looking for, someone who would elicit the proper emotion from the president. Aziz circled the group looking for the face of Sally Burke, the president's secretary and mother of five. If the president's bodyguards chose to fight, Mrs. Burke would be used as a shield. Aziz found her sitting with a group of women. With his long, thin finger, he gestured for her to join him. Burke pointed to herself nervously and asked,
"Me?"
"Yes, you, Mrs. Burke."
Smiling, Aziz extended his hand to help the woman to her feet. Burke reluctantly grabbed it and stood.
"What do you want with me?"
"Don't worry. Everything will be all right. We just need you to talk to someone."
"Who?"
"Don't worry. Everything will be just fine."
Aziz squeezed his shoulder and again told her not to worry. Then, gently, he turned her toward the door and led her from the room. Bringing his radio to his mouth, he said,
"Muammar, meet me in the press room."
To Rapp's left was the hall leading to the main entrance for the first floor. To his right was the press room and a door that led out onto the colonnade. Rapp wanted to check both of them and see if they were as strongly defended as the doors in the president's dining room and the one in the Oval Office. As Rapp headed for the press room, he heard an increase in the chatter over his headset. At the same time, he heard voices from somewhere ahead. He began rapidly backpedaling down the hallway. General Campbell came over the headset, his voice rushed.
"Iron Man, we're out of time. They've stopped drilling and are getting ready to open the bunker door."
Rapp couldn't respond at the moment. He had more urgent things to worry about and didn't want to give himself away by making any more noise than he had to. He made it back to the pantry seconds later and ducked out of the hallway alongside Adams. He whispered into his headset,
"Are you sure?"
"Yes."
"How much time do we have?"
They cut through the dining room and into the hallway where he pushed open the wall panel.
"We're not sure."
Rapp closed the wall behind him and gestured for Adams to start moving down the stairs.
"What's our best guess?" he whispered.
There was some discussion on the other end and then,
10 minutes tops."
Rapp and Adams hit the landing outside of horsepower and Rapp pushed Adams into the tunnel. Once they were inside, Rapp closed the door so he could speak without worry of being heard.
"Control, let's take it from the top. The place is wired to the gills and we've only seen a quarter of it. Our only shot is to get these SEALs in here and have them defuse a point of entry for HRT.
"We've got another problem. We just discovered that one of the monitors in horsepower is tuned to a rooftop camera."
Rapp thought about it quickly and came up with a solution. "I'll wait down here, and if the Tango in horsepower sees them come in, I'll take him out." Rapp looked at Adams and waited for Campbell's reply. He quickly grew frustrated with being cut out of the discussion process on the other end. After more than 10 seconds of waiting, he shouted into his lip mic,
"Irene, are you there?"
"Yes."
"Keep me in the loop. I'm your only on-site asset, and we don't have time to debate every point."
General Flood came on the line.
Iron Man, we've got some logistical problems. We were off by almost 30 minutes on our last estimate, and we can't afford to be off by that much again. Not with the President's life on the line. Then bring Delta in quicker, but we have to get Harris and his boys going or those hostages are all dead.
They might be anyway, stated General Campbell. I'd say right now the chances of getting HRT in that building are between slim and none. And if we do get them in, the chances of them coming out alive aren't much better.
Rapp was pissed. The minutes were ticking away, and people were getting cold feet.
I need help. I can take out the Tango in horsepower. I can maybe take out the Tango up in the Roosevelt room, but there's no way I can contend with all of these bombs and take out the Tangos in the mess. We need to take some risks.
Flood's deep voice came over the headset.
We don't want to see the hostages die either, but we're not about to send good men on a suicide mission.
We're paid to take risks, General Flood. You've been out in the field, and if you were 20 years younger, you would want in no matter how bad the odds. Put the question to Harris and his men, and I'll guarantee they'll want in.
There was a moment of silence, and then General Campbell said,
I agree. We have to try.
Kennedy and Stansfield agreed with Campbell, which put all the pressure on General Flood. It was a risky operation, but they had to try. Flood knew it. After a brief moment of reflection, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs gave the approval. The second he did so, General Campbell turned around and started barking orders to the JSOC staff sitting in front of him. The officers in turn relayed the orders over secure lines. The MC-130 combat Talon was 3 minutes away from the jump point when they received the go-ahead from JSOC. The navigator informed Commander Harris of the countdown, and the four SEALs moved to the back ramp with their bulky chutes and packs. Under their left arms, their suppressed Heckler & Koch MP-10 submachine guns were safely secured. The four men stood in single file at the top of the ramp. Reavers, the jumpmaster, was first in line. He checked everyone's chute one last time and then took up his place in the number one slot. Harris walked up to Reaver's side and looked out at the horizon. To the west, the sun was now down, but the sky above it was still lit. To the east, it looked as if the world were about to end. The sky was black from as far to the north and east as the eye could see. Looking down, Harris could see the beltway running east to west, and to his right was the University of Maryland. Beyond the university, the city of Baltimore was getting pounded by the storm. The commander could tell from the trees below that it was gusting hard. Mick Reavers yelled into his CO's ear,
"Great weather to jump in. Who's the crazy bastard that came up with this plan?"
Harris smiled.
"We've been in worse situations, Mick. Just make sure you hike up your skirt before you jump. We wouldn't want it to get caught on anything."
Reavers gave his boss the bird. Harris smiled at the big slab of beef before him and slapped Reavers on the shoulder. Returning to his spot at the end of the stick, the commander checked the altimeter strapped to his left wrist and waited for the signal. Through the eerie red light of the cabin, the green jump light began to flash. Almost instantly, Reavers raised his right hand and gave the signal for the men to stand by. Seconds later, Reavers gave the go signal and leapt from the open ramp of the combat Talon. Tony Clark came next, then Jordan Rostein, and lastly Dan Harris pivoted and leapt from the plane. All four men turned 180 degrees in the air and assumed the freefall position known as the frog, arms and legs extended and bent slightly upward. In the darkening sky, the luminescent tape on their helmets helped them keep track of each other and line up. Beneath them and to the south, the White House was easily identifiable. Rapp was receiving steady updates from Langley while he tried to think of potential problems. He had identified many, but there were two he could actually do something about. He turned to Adams and asked,
"Is that door to horsepower locked?"
"Yes."
"Does the S key open it?"
"Yep."
Rapp nodded to Adams. "Take the monitor off quick." As Adams started to do so, Rapp grabbed his lip mic and said,
"Control, I am sending Milt up to the roof to guide the team through the tunnel."
General Campbell came back.
"Are you sure we need to do that? They've studied the blueprints."
"We can't afford any screw-ups. Milt knows the way. Rapp flipped his lip mic up. Milt, bust your ass back over there and grab my silenced pistol from Anna. I don't want you using yours. Tell her to hurry back over here because I need her help. Then you get up to the back staircase that leads to the roof. Someone will be talking to you on the radio and telling you if the coast is clear. When you hear that the snipers have taken the shot at the terrorist in the guard booth, I want you to pop that hatch immediately. If that terrorist is still alive, you are to put him down. You cannot allow him to say anything over the radio. Rapp grabbed the monitor from Adams and started him down the stairs. Hurry up, Milt! Adams raced down the stairs with amazing agility for his age and disappeared into the tunnel. Rapp checked his watch and listened to the radio chatter coming over his headset. Waiting for Reilly to get back, he tuned the monitor into the surveillance unit that was mounted just outside of horsepower. The image of the back of the terrorist's head appeared on the screen. Less than 30 seconds later, Anna Reilly hustled up the stairs out of breath and holding her side. Rapp looked at her and asked, "Is it your rib?" Reilly nodded with a look of pain on her face. "Just hang in there a little while longer. Here's what I need you to do." Rapp held up his S key. "There's a door on the other side of this, and that key opens it. In that room, one of the terrorists is watching surveillance monitors. We might need to take him out, but we don't want to unless we absolutely have to."
"So you want me to open the door with this?"
"Yes. I'm going to open this door, and once I do that, we have to talk in whispers. Just do everything I tell you to do when I tell you to do it, and we'll be fine." Rapp punched in the code for the door, leaned on the handle, and stepped into the landing area. He set the monitor and his MP10 on the ground. Dropping to a key, Rapp moistened the jagged end of the S key with spit. When he had it wet enough, he grabbed the doorknob with one hand and brought the tip of the key to the lock. Looking back and forth between the monitor and the lock, he began to slide the key in. It was inserted a third of the way when Rapp stopped. The terrorist leaned back his chair and clasped his hands behind his neck. Rapp didn't move, didn't breathe for 5 seconds. Then slowly, he slid the key the rest of the way in. He leaned back and gestured for Reilly to join him on the ground. Pulling her close, he whispered into her ear, "When I give you the signal, I want you to grab the key and the doorknob. After that, if you hear me say the word, go, open it as quickly as possible, and then get out of the way." 3 MD-530 Little Bird helicopters worked their way up the Potomac River. The small, agile, and quiet helicopters were being flown by the elite pilots of the Army's 160th Special Operations Regiment, the Night Stalkers. Each helicopter carried 4 Delta Force operators. The commandos stood on the chopper's landing skids, 2 to a side. The helicopters approached the group of bridges just to the south of the George Mason Memorial Bridge, skimming the windswept waters of the Potomac. Instead of climbing to fly over the bridges, the pilots of the 160th continued to hug the deck. Under the 4 bridges they went, working their way north and closer to the White House. They were to stay out of sight until given the green light. The choppers closed on the Arlington Memorial Bridge and began to slow. When they reached it, the 3 choppers pulled in under the bridge and hovered. This was where they were to wait. Meanwhile, a second flight of 3 Little Birds worked its way up the Anacostia River to the northeast. The 3 helicopters passed over the Frederick Douglass Bridge and turned north. Skimming over the roofs of apartment buildings and row houses, they cruised at an easy 60 knots, keeping the noise of their rotors and engines nice and quiet. The choppers passed around the east side of the Capitol so no one out on the National Mall would notice them. The wind buffeted them as they turned west and cruised over the roof of the Department of Labor. Dead ahead, 5 blocks away, was the monolithic structure of the Hoover Building. The choppers slid in over the rooftop and hovered just 5 feet above the structure. That was where they were to wait. The operators standing on the skids were loaded for bear. Each man was outfitted with the latest in body armor, including ballistic Kevlar helmets and throat protectors. Gas masks were readily accessible in spare pockets, as were night vision goggles. 10 of the 12 men carried suppressed MP-10s. The 11th carried a Mossberg 12-gauge shotgun, and the 12th carried the heavy 7.62mm M60ES machine gun. All of them were confident they could overcome anything they met, with one exception, the bombs. If the SEALs didn't find a way around them, they would be in for a real nasty operation. Chapter 51. Four blocks away from the White House, in the bell tower of the old post office, Charlie Wicker slid in behind his 50-caliber Barrett sniping rifle and was looking through his Leopold M1 Ultra 10x scope. On the wooden platform next to him, his fellow SEAL sniper Mike Berg was doing the same thing with another of the exact same massive weapon. The acoustic top was on the shooting platform. Constructed out of plywood and lined with foam, the covers would absorb 95% of the significant noise when the 50-caliber rifles were fired. Wicker was very confident the shot would work. So confident that he thought he would get the Tango on the first shot. If he didn't, he knew Berg would. The odds of them missing from this distance were almost zero. The only thing that made him nervous was the weather. Wind and rain did funny things to the flight of a bullet, things that he couldn't always control, and that drove him nuts. The wind had been steadily increasing for the last several hours, but as if they had been given a gift from above, it had just died down. Unfortunately, Wicker knew, the reprieve would only be temporary. They were in the proverbial calm before the storm. The black sky was descending from the east, and the relative calm would not last. Wicker had been listening to the play-by-play as his team members jumped out the back of the combat Talon and was relieved the operation was underway. He would make the shot count. Only Wicker could hear what was being said between Harris and the other three jumpers. Having too many operators on the radio created unneeded confusion. Berg was to take his shot after he heard Wicker take his. There would be no command, no signals, nothing to distract the second shot. Berg would shoot when he was ready. The two snipers could clearly hear their spotters outside the blind calling out the descent of the four SEAL Team 6 operators. Wicker focused entirely on the task at hand. His whole body was molded to the big 50-caliber rifle as the crosshairs of his scope stayed centered on the terrorist's head. Wicker felt no remorse over what he was about to do. The man he was about to kill had put himself in this situation, and he had miscalculated the skill of his opponent. He naively sat behind the bulletproof glass, thinking he was safe. At 1,000 feet, Mick Reavers pulled the ripcord on his parachute, and his rapid descent stopped. Looking up, he decided to make sure his double canopy had unfurled itself properly, then maneuvered himself into position for the short glide onto the roof of the White House. Reavers didn't bother to look to see if his team members were in position above him. His job was to stay online so the others could follow. Harris had also opened his chute as close to 1,000 feet as possible. After he got himself sorted out, he did a quick count of the airfoils beneath him and moved in to line up behind Rothstein. At the same time, he looked over at the tall steeple of the old post office and said, "Slick, this is Whiskey 4. Do you copy? Over."
"I copy, Whiskey 4.
"We're getting close.
Just give me the bingo."
Harris floated down, looking beyond his men at the street and traffic lights. Suddenly, he felt a gust of wind, and then a raindrop touched his cheek. Looking back to the east, he could see a wall of driving rain marching toward him. The heavy stuff looked to be less than a mile away. Harris looked down and tried to judge how close Reavers was to touchdown. Harris checked his altimeter, and then looked back to the lead chute. He waited patiently, watching Reavers glide in from the darkness toward the roof of the White House. Harris waited to the last possible moment and said,
"Bingo, Slick. I repeat, bingo."
Wicker heard the call and began a slow, even exhale. He had already lowered his heart rate to fewer than 40 beats a minute and was completely at ease. The terrorist was offering him a full profile shot, and Wicker held the center of the crosshairs just above the man's ear. With a steady, constant pressure, he began to squeeze the trigger, and with a loud report, the bullet was away. The recoil from the massive rifle jolted Wicker back several inches. Another round was chambered, and as he maneuvered his scope in an attempt to reacquire the target, he heard Berg's massive 50 launch its round at the target. Wicker brought his scope back in on the guard booth a second later, but there was nothing to shoot. The only thing in sight was a large hole in the bulletproof glass the size of a fist. Reavers came in hot. He had felt the wind picking up and had adjusted accordingly, allowing himself to drop like a rock for 30 feet, and then at the last second he pulled down on the risers and filled his chute with air. When his feet hit the roof, he opened the vents and got enough slack in his canopy to collapse one side of it. Clutching at his shoulder hooks, he pulled them from the main harness and wrestled the chute to the ground. Reavers bundled the chute quickly, threw it out of the way, all the while running for the guard booth. On the way, he reached for his machine gun and said,
"Whiskey One is down and on the move."
By the time Reavers got to the guard booth, his silenced MP10 was up and ready. As he looked inside, he saw the semi-decapitated body of a terrorist lying on the floor. Reporting his findings, he said,
"Tango One is out of commission."
Reavers looked up for a second to see how the others were doing, and then began to check the guard booth for booby traps. Clark and Rothstein came in much the same as Reavers. There was a pattern that was developing, though, and as Reavers finished circling the guard booth, he grew alarmed. Each man overshot the previous man's landing area by a good 20 feet. Reavers looked up and saw his CO struggling to get down as the wind picked up. With no time to waste, Reavers began running toward the western edge of the roof. As he did so, the rain started to fall. Commander Harris was allowing himself to drop at a dangerous rate in an effort to get down before he overshot the landing area. With less than 15 feet to go, he pulled on his risers as hard as he could. The chute fluffed with air, and just as the commander's feet hit the roof, a 40-mile-an-hour gust grabbed the parachute and yanked Harris toward the edge. Rapp knelt outside the door to horsepower, intently watching his monitor. Reilly knelt next to him, afraid to speak. They had been sitting in silence for several minutes, waiting, when Rapp noticed her look of fear. A little bit of fear was a good thing, but too much could lead to freezing in the heat of battle, and they couldn't afford that right now. Rapp pushed the lip mic of his headset up and leaned close to Reilly. Whispering in her ear, he said,
"Don't worry, Anna. Everything is going to be fine."
Rapp moved away and smiled. Reilly looked at him with eyes filled with dread. She leaned in close and whispered in his ear,
"I don't want you to die."
Then she hugged him and kissed him on the cheek. Rapp's heart fluttered, and he felt a feeling in his stomach that he hadn't felt in a long time. With a huge grin on his face, he pulled her close, touching his forehead to hers. "Don't worry about me. I've been in worse situations than this, much worse." He felt like kissing her, but held back. "Besides, you owe me dinner." This finally got a smile from her, and after a couple of seconds she added,
"All right. Just don't do anything stupid before I get a chance to pay you back."
Before Rapp could reply, he heard Commander Harris and Charlie Wicker talking on the headset. Rapp pulled his mic back down and pointed to the doorknob. Reilly nervously put one hand on the knob and the other on the key. Rapp brought his silenced MP10 up with both hands and clutched the extended stock firmly between his cheek and shoulder. With his eyes on the monitor, he kept the gun level and ready to fire. He listened to the news as the shot was taken, and then the words that the first SEAL was down. Rapp looked for the slightest sign that the terrorist was onto something. The seconds passed by, and there was nothing. It appeared they had eliminated the tango on the roof without alerting the others. Then came the news that the second and third SEALs were down. Rapp started to ease up just a bit. Amazingly, everything was going off as planned. Harris was helpless as the wind filled his chute and yanked him toward the edge. Passing by one of the chimney stacks, he reached out with his left hand. This slowed him for only a second as the force of the gale peeled him away from his temporary brick mooring. Several feet off the ground, he was again airborne and headed for the edge.
"Whiskey Four is in trouble,"
announced Reavers, as he sprinted across the narrow flat section of the roof. Pumping his legs as fast as they would move, he saw his CO slow for a second and then start moving. Reavers gained on him, and when he thought he had a chance, he dropped his weapon clear and leapt, both hands extended. Reavers caught Harris's right boot, and they came to a skidding halt. Only half of Harris's upper body was on the roof. The other half was dangling over the edge, the parachute fully inflated by the driving storm continuing to tug him from Reavers' grip. With Reavers preventing him from floating away, Harris got enough play in one of the main straps to undo the clasp and let it go. The chute instantly flattened and began snapping in the wind. With the tension reduced, the other clasp was free and released in seconds. The parachute then floated away for about 50 feet until it hit the southeast corner of the west wing. There it came to rest, flapping in the wind, hugging the building. Rapp honestly thought they were about to pull off the infiltration without a hitch, and then he heard the call that Whiskey Four was in trouble. His ears perked up, and his eyes intently watched the small monitor at his feet. The terrorist on the screen was sitting with his back to the door. Rapp could see the Tango's AK-74 leaning against the table within arm's reach. After several tense seconds, it came over the radio that Whiskey Four was okay and that the team was proceeding into the mansion. Rapp eased a bit, and then he saw the Tango come forward in his chair. Rapp's body shifted forward as he continued to watch the small screen at his feet. The Tango had seen something on one of the monitors, but Rapp couldn't see what it was. When the terrorist's left hand reached out, Rapp noticed what looked like a radio sitting on the console.
"Go!"
The word came from his mouth without any thought or pause. Reilly turned the key, twisted the knob, and shoved the door open. Rapp was moving through the opening instantly, his silenced MP10 hugged tight and his left eye boring down the sights. The terrorist's head was framed perfectly. The radio was coming to his mouth. He had already got the name Rafik out and was just starting to say something else. Rapp squeezed the trigger once and held it for a second. Two rounds spit from the end of the silencer and hit the Tango directly in the back of the head. The hollow-point glazier rounds breached the skull and released a total of 660 lethal miniature projectiles. The terrorist was propelled forward, his head landing on the console and his radio dropping to the floor. Rapp moved quickly for the terrorist's radio, saying over his lip mic, "I need help. Get the whiskey team over here on the double." Keeping his gun trained on the open door that led out into the hallway, he grabbed the radio and brought it up to his ear. The voice he heard on the other end caused Rapp's skin to crawl. It was Aziz. Rapp had to think fast. Speaking into his own headset first, he said, "Control, we may have to go with jamming. Be ready to do so on my command." Rapp thought about how to play it. After just a second or two, he brought the radio to his mouth and hoped his clipped Farsi accent would work.
"Everything's all right. It was nothing."
There was silence for a moment, and then Aziz asked,
"Who is this?"
Rapp hesitated for only a second. Into his lip mic he said,
"Control, jam everything. I repeat, everything."
Chapter 52. Aziz looked at the door to the president's bunker, and then at the electronic device in his hand. He spoke into his radio for a third time and then held it to his ear. Nothing came back. Without having to be asked, Benghazi tried his radio. The result was the same. Aziz calmly checked the digital pager clipped to his hip and then looked at Benghazi.
"Take Raghib, check the stairwell, and try to re-establish radio contact."
Aziz then turned to Yassin, who was sticking a long, spike-like object through one of the holes he had drilled.
"Keep working," he told the plump little man.
Aziz walked down the hallway, followed by his men, and when they reached the stairwell, he waited for them at the bottom. As Benghazi and Raghib disappeared into the stairwell, Aziz tried his radio again. It still didn't work. Now he began to get nervous. If the radios failed, that was one thing. But if the Americans were jamming them and they covered the frequencies of his digital pagers, that would be something entirely different. The countdown would begin on the bombs, and if the Americans did not stop jamming the signal, there was nothing he could do to stop them from going off. He had only several options, and he didn't have a lot of time to think them through. Rapp stood next to the main doorway of Horsepower, looking down the hall, waiting for a Tango to come around the corner any second. Reilly had ventured into the room and was staring at the dead terrorist. Rapp brought his hand up and motioned for her to get behind him. She didn't see his gesture, and Rapp said,
"Anna, get over here and stay behind me."
Rapp looked back down the hall again and said,
"Whiskey 4, where in the hell are you?"
"We're in the tunnel. We'll be there in a second."
"Hurry up."
Commander Harris, who was in the lead, passed a tired Milt Adams and sprinted up the stairs. He arrived in Horsepower with his weapon up and sweeping the room. Rapp heard him enter and turned.
"We need to take these guys out quick before they figure out what's going on."
"What about the bombs?" The other three black-clad SEALs entered the room.
"We pray they don't go off while we're shooting, and we worry about them later."
"Slow down a minute,"
General Campbell's voice came over their radios.
"We need to make sure we know what we're doing first."
"We've got one Tango upstairs watching a half a dozen hostages or more,"
Rapp spoke rapidly.
"We're blind in the mess, but we know there's at least three Tangos watching over the hostages. There's nothing else to discuss. These guys are going to get real antsy if they don't start hearing something on their radios. We need to move now."
"I agree." Harris backed up Rapp.
"What's the Tango in the Roosevelt room doing?" asked Rapp.
"Nothing. He's just sitting in his chair. But Aziz and several others are on the move."
"Where's Delta?"
"They're on their way in."
Rapp looked at Harris.
"The mess is down the hall, first left and then first right. Take your team and clear the room. I'll go upstairs and take care of the loner."
"Why don't I give you Mick?"
Rapp shook his head.
"Thanks, but I don't need him. I've got video of what he's doing. You're flying blind. You need the extra man more than I do."
Rapp started to move for the other door. He grabbed Reilly's hand and said to Harris and the boys,
"Good luck. I'll see you in about 20 seconds.
When Rapp reached the back steps, Milt Adams was slowly climbing the staircase from the tunnel. He looked exhausted. Turning to Reilly, Rapp said,
"Wait here with Milt."
Then, on the way up the stairs to the Oval Office, he remembered all of the bombs. Into his lip mic, he said,
"Control, you'd better start thinking of a way to get us out of here."
Back at Langley, Kennedy was already on the job. Things were moving along at a frantic pace. General Campbell's Joint Special Operations Command staff was busy monitoring every aspect of the mission and telling the general only the things he needed to be most concerned about. Fortunately, everyone in the room had received enough training and, in some cases, real-life experience that they knew to keep their mouths shut unless what they had to say was imperative. During a frenetic operation like this, it was easy to swamp the lines of communications. Kennedy tapped Campbell on the arm.
"I'll handle Iron Man. You worry about the whiskey team."
Campbell nodded his consent. Colonel Gray, the commander of Delta Force, was to his right and overseeing the actions of his Alpha and Bravo teams. The Alpha team was on the move and about to be inserted onto the roof. The Bravo team had left its cover under the Arlington Bridge and was on its way in. General Flood and Director Stansfield sat in the back row and watched. They were both very careful not to interrupt. Kennedy looked at the three monitors on the big board that most concerned Rapp.
"Iron Man, you are all clear. There is no movement in the hallway, and the Tango is sitting with his gun resting on his lap."
Kennedy squinted at the screen.
"There's a chance he could be sleeping."
"Roger that."
Rapp climbed the steep concrete staircase that led to the Oval Office. When he reached the top, he pressed the latch and pulled the wall in toward him. He checked to his left first, and then moved through the dining room and into the pantry. There he stopped and looked out at the door across the hallway.
"Whiskey 4, are you in position? Over."
Harris and his three SEALs were crouched against the wall just outside the White House mess. Having gone through this drill together countless times, they fell into their slots. Reavers was number one, followed by Clark, Rothstein, and finally Harris, the same way they had jumped out of the plane. We're ready to go on your command, Iron Man.
Before moving, Rap asked, How does my Tango look, Control?
No change in status, replied Kennedy.
Roger that. All right, Harry, let's bag 'em on three. One, Rap moved across the hall. Two, he placed his right hand on the doorknob. Three! Rap threw the door open and stayed in his crouch. The Tango looked up, and as he did so, the thick black suppressor of Rap's submachine gun coughed twice. Downstairs, Mick Reavers raced into the White House mess in a crouch and peeled to his left, sweeping his area for targets. A split second into the room-clearing maneuver, he found one. The Tango was standing with his weapon cradled across his chest. Reavers placed two rounds directly in the center of the man's forehead and sent him to the ground. The next three SEALs came in right on top of Reavers, each man peeling away and searching their area. Tony Clark, the number two man in the train, found his target 30 feet away and directly across the room. The Tango was bringing his gun up to fire, but it never happened. Two bullets hit him right between the eyes and sent him back over a chair. As Jordan Rothstein entered the room, he peeled further to the right and came up blank. He fought the urge to sweep further to his right and went back over his area again. Harris was right on his heels and pivoted 90 degrees to cover the area all the way to the right. No more than 8 feet away, the snubbed muzzle of a shortened AK-74 was being brought to bear. Harris was quicker and sent two rounds into the man's face. Reavers called clear, and he was followed in quick succession by the other team members. They heard Rapp's call over their radios, and then several of the hostages began to cry out for help. The SEALs ignored them and kept their weapons up as they searched the mass of hostages for any Tangos that might be using them for cover. Harris ordered Clark and Rothstein to watch the hostages, and then he and Reavers moved out to secure the other areas of the room. Chapter 53. The three Little Bird helicopters moved out from their holding pattern and raced in over the White House. The rain was falling in sheets and the wind was howling. Most helicopter pilots had the common sense to stay on the ground during weather like this, but the pilots of the 160th Special Operations Regiment trained in the worst possible conditions for this exact reason. The only adjustment they made was to loosen their formation a bit to allow for some error that might be caused by the gusting wind. The first little bird came in and hovered 10 feet off the deck over the eastern end of the roof. The no-tar system on the chopper's tail gave it unmatched hovering stability. All four troopers kicked free at the same time and rappelled the short distance to the rooftop. The men pulled their ropes from their rappelling clips and headed out for the guard booth. The second chopper came right behind the first and then the third. The 12 operators of the Alpha team immediately set out for their objective in the basement. Aziz was trying to figure out what to do when he heard the distinctive noise of an AK-74 being fired somewhere on the floors above. The noise caused him to freeze at first, and then he raced back to the anteroom of the bunker. Neither Racine nor the woman had any idea that something was wrong. Aziz grabbed the woman by the arm and yanked her to her feet. Pulling the woman down the hall, he yelled back to Yassine, "Get that door open!" As they neared the stairwell, shots could be heard again. Aziz opened the door and yelled for Benghazi. He waited a moment, but got no reply. Furious at all this, when he was so close, he grabbed the woman by the hair and shoved her into the stairwell. He had to get to the first basement, or there would be no escape. Aziz pushed the woman before him as the noise of battle grew louder. When they made it to the first basement, he pressed on. At the next landing, they found Benghazi and Raghib. The two of them were firing furiously at the stairs above them. Brass shell casings came tumbling down the steps. A hail of bullets hit the plaster wall just in front of them, and chips of the wall flew in every direction. Aziz began backing down the staircase, yelling to Benghazi, "Muammar, hold on for another minute, and then meet me in the tunnel." Without turning, Benghazi yelled, "Go!" As Aziz headed back down the stairs, there was a bright flash and a loud bang from above. He reached the door to the first basement and burst through it with the president's secretary. Using her as a shield, he checked both directions and then headed for the treasury tunnel.
He had to fight all of his urges to go back downstairs and see things through with the president, but he knew that would end only one way. This was it. He had been so close, but somehow the Americans had figured out what he was up to. Aziz rounded the next corner to the left and stopped. Holding the woman up in front of him, he brought his fist back and then punched her with a right hook. The woman